We are now on continuing with chapter 7, which is both part A and part B, not 2 but 1. So I want to say one thing and then I want to turn it over to some of you who have things from last week that we didn't complete and things from this week. So, when we talk about one, we need to see that the all is in that one. In other words, even though it says one and all, if we say one, one always has, you could say, the background of the all, or the backside of the all. Otherwise, we get stuck in likes and dislikes about the one or the other, the is and isn't of the one, the exclusion and inclusion. And yet, the one is just the one as it is, and it isn't anything else, and just the one as it isn't. Since the one as one is all, not the one because it's an all, but the one as one, meaning this particular, whether it's so-called myself or so-called another, whether it's so-called doing this or doing that, there is no other all other than this one right here, listening to me or speaking right now. We could say just this moment as is. And likewise, and of course all of this is explanatory, but I'll say it anyway, the all, whatever the all we are attending to is, this all is only in this one, this moment. Other than that, it's just a fantasy. If we look elsewhere and search elsewhere, then we miss the all in talking about the so-called one that's elsewhere. But, as I said, all of this is explanatory. And as he quotes Nansen, also known as Nanchuan in Chinese, where he responds to the person saying people see this as if it's in a dream, because then it's become something conceptual. If we hold on to ideas about the one and all, or even hold on to not one, not two, it becomes a dream. So in a way, sometimes we say only don't know, or always say vast emptiness, no holiness, or not one, not two, but we could say not two as well, and not other than. Not this, but not other than this. So in one sense, it's very easy for us to get caught up in words, and yet we have to use words to explain it and to encourage us to take a step further in practice and in clarifying this matter. Okay, so I know people had things they wanted to say about the first part of this, from page 59 on, the one and all and the all and one to part A. So if you want to bring some things up from that, which we talked about a little last week, please do.
Okay, I know you just mentioned it, but I'd like for you to explain it to again. The phrase, not two, not one.
Well, take it more as a precaution. In other words, we naturally, so to speak, not really naturally, but culturally naturally, and human tendencies naturally, we tend to see things dualistic. Self and other, things I want and things I don't want or don't have, that's dualistic. So in one sense, we need to clarify that practice is about seeing that it's not two, not self versus the world, or not a self that excludes the world, or we can call it a dualism. There's no problem with dualism, but if we don't see the underlying truth of non-dualism, then the dualism becomes a trap. But otherwise, the dualism is fine. When you go into the store and you check out and you say, well, I don't have to go through checkout because it's non-dual, so I could walk out. No, that's nonsense. So, sure, dualism. You take and you pay the clerk, and the clerk gives you change, or you fill out, you put in your credit card and then you sign or whatever and you get the receipt. That's exactly non-dual. I think I've mentioned this in the past. This was long before any such things as credit cards used regularly, etc. But when we used to come on the George Washington Bridge across from New Jersey into New York, or New York into New Jersey, that was the way we used to come and go to Daibusatsu Zendo. So once we were going with Soen Roshi, and at that time the toll was $1.50. So we gave $2 bills, and we received back two quarters change. And Soen Roshi says, wonderful Dharma exchange. Two of the Bodhisattva George Washingtons, and we get back two Bodhisattva George Washingtons. So, because we gave two Washington $1 bills, George Washington is on the $1 bill, yes, or at least he was at that time. And we got back to Washington, but the quarters. But the point was, it's the Dharma exchange of not two, not one. So we could make a wonderful Dharma exchange, but not get caught up in a dualism of I gave you and you should give me, or I gave you and you gave me, so, you know, it's dualistic. Instead, we see it's a Dharma exchange of not two, exchanging and giving and receiving. That's not two.
And not one.
And not one, because, of course, you can't go to the toll operator and say, well, we're one, so I don't have to give you pay my toll. That's a kind of what's called a pernicious oneness, where it's conceptually that way, but really it's just becomes a way to perpetuate and reinforce our self-centeredness.
Okay, I have two other questions.
Sure.
But they're about number 7, the chapter 7.
Chapter 7.
Do you want me to wait, or can I?
You mean part B?
Yeah.
Because all of this is chapter 7. So sure.
Oh, okay. Well, part A was.
Go ahead.
All right. So go ahead.
Yes.
All right. In the very first paragraph, the Song of Enlightenment, non-Buddhists are clever but have no wisdom.
Yes. What he means, and I don't, you know, didn't write the poem, but what he's saying is they don't see the wisdom, which is the wisdom that sees the universality or the absolute nature, as opposed to simply the skillful dualistic. That's what the point is, I gather.
So, like Buddha nature.
Yes, you could say it that way.
Okay, then my second question is, will you go down 1, 2, 3, the beginning of the fourth paragraph?
Which begins with?
If a person opens his inner eyes, what are the inner eyes?
The inner eye means that you have, you see beyond the usual dualistic, don't go looking inside your body for the inner eye. It's seeing beyond the usual dualistic self and not self, or self and other, or beyond the dualistic I am and I'm not, or I like and I don't like, or I should have and shouldn't have. That's what he's saying. That's the absolute. In other words, in Zen practice, we call that having some opening into seeing and experiencing, not conceptually, but in experientially, the oneness of reality, or the non-dualness of reality. Now, okay. Of course, this occurs in all sorts of degrees and extents, so this could happen and then we jump right back into our usual self-centered habits. And then, you know, it becomes a daydream that once upon a time I saw this, but it doesn't inform how we live. That's what, when we say in the Heart Sutra, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva doing deep prajnapara, Mita clearly saw the emptiness of all five conditions. Form is exactly empty. Empty is exactly form. So.
Okay. I have another question, but that's later on. I won't hog all the time.
You could bring it up now and we'll come back.
Well, I need some clarification about the absolute and the relative.
Ah, okay. Let's leave that for now. The more I talk about the absolute, the more it's much chatter that doesn't take us anywhere.
Okay.
But we'll see. Since he talks about it, we'll need to talk about it. So, you could say the absolute is seeing the emptiness of all the five conditions. You could say the absolute, well, that's enough for me for now. We'll see what else. Because that's not enough, but still, that's good enough for right now. Experientially, that's seeing that.
I have a question about page 60.
60, okay, let's... So you have to speak
now?
Up a little more. Page 60.
Page 60, it's the next to the last paragraph.
Yes.
It says, by any man who knows the Tao...
But any man who knows the Tao...
sees clearly that self and others are not two. I just wondered, is Tao... is that being incorporated into the way? Is that the same as saying the way?
Yes. So any person who knows the Tao, the way meaning the way which is reality manifesting at this moment, so that's... Now remember, this is an English translation of something that was written in Japanese. So I'm not, but yes. So here the Tao is, you could say, the equivalent of the way that we call the Buddha way.
Okay, I just wanted to know if we were crossing over into Taoism.
No. You have to know that the way Tao is equal to the Dharma or Buddha Dharma.
Okay. Or the path.
All sorts of different. Yeah. Okay. Depends on, depends on how it's being used.
Okay.
Now, saying that in generality is true, but nevertheless, despite, quote, knowing the Tao, we easily fall back and get trapped into all sorts of self-centered habits, and we forget, and it becomes just something that we know. I mean, for instance, Hakuin Zenji talks about that he had 17 or 18 major openings of where he saw the Tao, and maybe hundreds of minor openings, or tens of minor openings. So despite the fact that there's an opening, he very quickly would get caught up in something or other, and, you know, because these all sorts of openings and seeings are just little glimmers which are overtaken by our strong karmic habits and tendencies, which make us quickly forget or cease to live or fail to live what we know, which is why we practice ongoing. And even in formal practice with koan, there's koan after koan, and there's a whole discussion, many texts about practice after awakening, or after Kensho, as it's sometimes called, and that's lots of emphasis, or on, it's called realization and actualization, different ways of expressing it and talking about it, and different ways of emphasizing it, and stressing the importance of it.
When you mentioned before about, you know, going to the market or the store and then going out to the checkout or whatever, you know,
yes,
it reminded me somehow how it is when two people are playing catch.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's just sort of like it's one activity, and yet there's two people involved, and the whole thing is just responding to the ball being thrown, and, you know, that kind of thing. It's just like automatic. And so that, I feel like sometimes my call and response, I guess, with other people at any moment, just throughout my day, it feels like that sometimes.
Yes, and sometimes, if I could switch to metaphor for a moment, it's you're playing tennis or racquetball, and you're playing back and forth, and you're, like you say, one person throws and the other person catches, or one person hits it and the other person hits it, and you volley back and forth. Or you could be playing thinking, how am I going to get him or her? How am I going to beat them? How am I going to hit it so that... And then you're not doing that at all. It's, you know, it's a murderous game. Instead of it being a dance, you know, a dance, even in a sword fight could be a dance, or it could be an attempt to try to kill someone else. A match in the various martial arts can be an attempt to dance together with the Tao, or with the Wei, or with the energy, or it could be an attempt at all cost in any sort of way to defeat your enemy. Even though they're in the same dojo as you, it's all about defeating them. If I win, they lose. If they win, I lose. If they win, it's bad for me. Even if they're better than me, I have to find a way to, and you go from there, to defeat them or to cheat them or whatever. And we see, of course, in our society, the inability of certainly political leaders to work cooperatively for the good of the society or the polity, and instead see it when they win, and this is the zero-sum game, when they win, I lose, and so it's all about me winning. It's not about doing what's in the public interest. And then what you get is the perpetuation of that self-other dualism. See, the paragraph that Ken asked about, if you go to the top of that paragraph, that's on page 60, the next to the last paragraph. From the point of view of dualism, such person feels that if others receive benefits, the self will lose something. And we talked about this last week when I brought up zero-sum games, especially in finances and politics. And then he uses that example, which in a way is a very simple one, but a very useful one, where he at the end of this page, where the example of this person who was awakened in reciting the Kanon Sutra, where he uses the example, if you're in a vat filled with water, or say a hot tub, and you try to pull all the water to your side, it'll naturally escape. But if you give it over to the other side, then it naturally flows to you. And that's something that we can look at. How can I expand on this in my life? How can I expand on this in my life? Or how do I refuse to follow this along in my life? And we've talked about this example before, I've talked about, and this is a Buddhist tradition, but I gather it exists in other traditions, similar examples where they talk about the difference between heaven and hell, and you go to heaven and you see that people are sitting there and taped to their, or tied to their hands are these super long spoons that no matter how they attempt to use it, it can't reach their mouth because it's too long. It's much longer than the distance between their hand, their arm, and their mouth. So they could, and you go to hell and you see the same thing. And then someone says, well, you know the difference between heaven and hell. So there's these, so in hell, people have these super long spoons tied to their hands, and there's lots of food in front of them, and they can dip the spoons into their food, but they can't get it into the mouth because the spoons are much larger than the distance between their arms, the length of their arms, and the spoons. Does that make sense if you visualize it? So the hands are so long with the extension of the spoon that they can't feed themselves. So they're always going hungry. But then you go up to heaven or paradise, whatever you want to call it, and you see the same things. These people have the same spoons and the same difficulty of feeding themselves because they can't get the food into their mouth. But in heaven, people dip their spoons into the food and they turn to the person across the table from themselves and feed them with it. And then there's no problem because they feed the other and the other feeds them. That's the difference between heaven and hell. Same circumstance. We could turn it into heaven or we could turn it into hell. It depends on what we do with the conditions and circumstances that we're given. That's the point. But anyway, okay. So that's really what on the bottom of this page 60, that example is pointing out the difference between self-centeredness or not focusing just on self-centeredness. So, what does it mean, self and others are absolutely one?
Initially, I thought it was different than I think it is now. Where now, I think maybe what he's saying is that there's this, what he talked about earlier, like about the interrelationship.
Yes.
You can't have one without the other, or like he talks about the net. You know, if you,
yes.
Right? I think that may be more what he means than that we become one.
Yes. It's not the matter of becoming, it's realizing that always have been.
Where are you in the text?
I'm just I was just surmising from some of the examples he gave, the last, I think it's, hold on, he talks about, net.
The net is at the end of.
I think it's like 50. Well, you could even look at like at the bottom of 59. Yeah, it's at the bottom of page 59.
Yes.
One and all in one.
Yeah.
Illustrated by means of a fishing net.
Yeah.
And then if you go on to page 60, that first paragraph, thus each existence, no matter how small or inconspicuous, is the absolute meaning and value. But it has value only in relation to other existences, only when working harmoniously with it. Apart from the whole, each separate existence has no significance at all.
It's important to see that there's many subtleties in this, and it's not simply conceptual, but a matter of experiential. And because we can say we understand that conceptually, but we can't always, or we can see ways where we refuse to live that. And just because we understand the concept is only step A. And as he puts it, as he, meaning Yasutani, says at the end of page 65, Zazen is the way of realization as well as actualization, meaning actualizing what we see and what we realize. Because it's in the ongoing practice that we see how we actualize it in our life, or how we refuse to actualize it because we buy into our reactive habits or our reactive desires and angers and fears or greed or different ways we speak of entanglements of clinging, which seem natural to us and which more than seem natural occur because we're not present and we don't notice until we've bumped into something.
So is our practice then to notice when we're not kind of dissolved in that kind of oneness with an experiential thing?
I mean, yeah, but don't think of it as dissolved in, because if you're dissolved, then you can't answer me when you come to my window and you want to get a driver's license, and I ask you, what's your name? Can I see your ID? And you say, oh, I'm one with all. I'm not going to give you a driver's license.
I know, but that's just conceptually kind of trying to understand what they're saying here and not trying to just keep it there, but just notice for myself when I...
Yeah, but the conceptual is a little... We have to be careful with that.
Mm-hmm.
See, what does it mean if we say everything is different and yet everything is the same? That's what he ends with.
Right.
Everything is different and everything is the same. And if we get stuck on either side of that, we're in trouble. And yet it seems to us those are mutually contradictory and they're mutually true. And neither one of them is someplace we can get stuck in. And how do we do the dance so that when it's the same, we can be the same. When it's different, we can be different. And we don't mix them up. Otherwise, if you mix them up, then I don't want you cooking for me, because then you're just going to grab whatever spice is and you'll say, all the spices are the same, so I'll pour in whatever I want to pour in. It's all the same. No, no. If I'd like you not to put salt into my granola or put it, you know, but I would like, sugar on the strawberries that I want, but I'll take salt on the bread and butter, just a little bit of salt. So, you know, it's everything is different and everything is the same, and they're not mutually contradictory. And to be able to live it, or to be able to notice when we're refusing to do that, or when we believe other than that, then that's our practice. Notice that poem that he brings up on the last page. The field, mountains, men, grasses, and trees are nothing but the voice of the rooster, which remains and says, I hear the voice. Now notice whoever translated this adds in the question mark. I hear the voice, question mark. So who's hearing the voice? What remains and says, I hear the voice? And what's the question mark? See, it's the dance. And because that poem was, notice that's the poem of Osatsu, the disciple of Hakuin.
You know, I have a thought about not two but one.
Yes.
Recently, we've been kind of working in committees, like we have two treasurers and three tenzos and so on. And it's a very interesting experience.
Uh-huh.
Because it's one big job with two people or three people doing a oneness.
Yes. And it could be a dance, and in which case some person takes one step, another person takes another step, or it could be a fight in which one person pulls in one direction and the other person pulls in another direction. And there's both options.
In theory,
the president and the Congress are supposed to be doing a dance together. Could be that way, or could be they're fighting with each other. Both of those are potentially there. And sometimes You fight, and sometimes, or I shouldn't say fight, sometimes you disagree and then find something that works for all, and sometimes you don't disagree and don't find any solution. And sometimes you agree, but no one's happy. This is, in a sense, this is our ongoing life practice. Because first it's to see where we're blinded even to seeing beyond the one, so to speak. Because usually we're, as we say, caught in the self-centeredness. So that we have to take a further step beyond that and see this, if we want to use those words, the not one but two, or the one in all and the all in one, or to see the not two but one and the one that's in the two, the one in all and all in one. And this is, in a sense, our ongoing practice. And the universe, called our life, keeps on presenting opportunities of how we are getting stuck on one or the other side, and we refuse to see that form is exactly empty, empty is exactly form. Therefore, gate, gate, para gate. So, but I've been talking too much. So you've all read this, so let's see if there's anything more you have to say.
Absolute and relative.
Yeah. But what is absolute? Don't go getting caught in some idea of absolute somewhere else. Absolute is
now I know nothing.
Okay.
So please explain.
Oh, I have nothing to say.
Ellie, you. So yes. So we're getting closer to the end of. So on page 65.
Yes.
Where it talks about. I guess it's near the end of that page. The famous phrase, heaven, earth, and I are of the same root. All things and I are of one substance. It's found in the book Hoseron.
Yes.
It's not difficult to understand this concept intellectually, but it must not remain a concept. It must become part of one's life. Then he talks about Nansen scolded the official Rico, telling him that he must gain the experience for himself.
Yeah,
right?
That's at the top of the page. That's that first paragraph. That's that story. Rico was talking to Nansen and said, heaven and earth and I are the same root. All things are of one substance. That is marvelous expression. So Nansen was standing there with him, and they pointed to the flower in the garden and said, you shouldn't look at this flower as though you're dreaming. So this is, in a sense, the rest of the page is an explanation.